Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
Welcome to episode 77. The last 7 days, most of our listeners have been listening from Australia, the USA, and Singapore. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Bram Presser, author of the incredible book, The Book of Dirt. And coming up, we have Dervla McTiernan, author of The Ruin and the Scholar. However, today, we welcome Stuart Turton, debut novelist of the wonderful mind-bending novel The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, an original murder mystery inspired by Agatha Christie and awarded the Costa First Novel Award. Enjoy.
Welcome, Stuart. Thank you so much for spending time on the podcast with me today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, honestly, was such a brilliant and unique read, full of mystery and intrigue, and a book that I just couldn't get my head out of. I just needed to ask you, how did this idea emerge?
Absolute terror. It spawned in terror, is the idea. I wanted to write an Agatha Christie novel, like a straight up and down golden age crime story with the big isolated house and the upper class guests and pretty much everything that's in the book. But I didn't have a unique spin on it, so I didn't have anything to add or anything that would make it worth reading above an Agatha Christie book. And when I started thinking about, you know, unique ideas, I suddenly realised that she'd done them all. She'd written 80 books or something, and she'd done every good idea. It was so annoying. She's wrung the entire genre dry. So the quantum leap, the body swapping, the philosophy, the time travel, that's how far I had to go to make a unique Agatha Christie novel that she hadn't already done.
Well, can I say, it was one of the most unique novels I've read. And not only highly complex and intriguing, but it was funny at times as well. And I just thought it was so rich.
Because these characters, all of them got into my head. Like a lot of them, they just lived there and they started being these kind of independent creations. And when I put them in rooms to start talking to each other, it was almost like their sense of humour started to come out. They started telling jokes. They started doing interesting things. So a lot of the humour did purely come from that these two people would meet and find each other's company enjoyable.
I love that wearing of another person. And just for listeners who may not have read the book yet, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, Evelyn Hardcastle has been murdered hundreds of times each day. Aidan Bishop is too late to save her. The only way to break this cycle is to identify Evelyn's killer. But every time the day begins again, Aidan wakes in the body of a different guest. And there's 8 of them.
There are indeed, yeah, which is actually one less than was originally planned. Uh-huh. I ended up cutting one of the hosts out in the final edit just because it was a host too far.
I was actually thinking that one of the greatest challenges for you must have been creating 8 distinct characters that are very different from one another. Was this a challenge for you?
Do you know what? Actually, it really wasn't. It was one of the most fun parts of the book, but they all began with a plot problem more than anything else. So they all began, for example, I've got a morbidly obese banker, and he's actually there because I needed to slow the book down at that point. There'd been a lot of sort of dashing around and a lot of exploration, a lot of exposition, and I needed a character who would kind of sit in one or two rooms so I didn't have to explain or do lots of description about new parts of the house. And somebody who could think through and sort of like filter what the reader had already sort of gone through and start to make plans about what to do with that information. So that was a very specific plot thing that I needed to happen. So I built a character who would do that for me. And then over the top of that, I started layering quirks on, and that was what happened all the way through. So the next character, I then suddenly, because we'd had quite a slow period in the book, the next character started dashing around and getting into a fight. So I made him like a young, stupid guy who'd just be reckless. So that's kind of the way it went through all the way. And then over the top of that, I built in character traits.
I loved it. And, you know, we're speaking about Lord Ravencourt, the very large man. And honestly, the descriptions of him were just some of my favourite. I'm just going to read part of your book here. "I can hear myself eating, the crush and the crack, the squelch and the gulp. Gravy runs down my chins, grease smearing my lips with a ghastly shimmering shine. Such is the ferocity of my appetite that I leave myself panting between mouthfuls, my napkin resembling a battlefield." I loved all the descriptions of Lord Ravencourt. That was so disgusting, but that was so great.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, there was a lot of stuff in that where I wanted to make the descriptions are kind of... So my main, the guy who is like in these hosts, Adam, he's experiencing these bodies for the first time. And the idea with Ravencourt was always that he's come from a very slight build man into a guy who is huge, like morbidly obese, and he is reviled by him, he's disgusted by him, whether that's fur or not, that's his immediate impression. So I wanted to give it a kind of almost body horror feel, that he was kind of appalled by the things that were happening to him, that this body was making him do. And actually, as he goes through it, he begins to really value this guy, really begins to value his mind, but while he's in him, he really treats him badly.
And I thought that was interesting as well, not only from character perspective, but from a reader's perspective about, you know, being empathetic and actually being in someone else's skin and wearing their body and all their limitations, you know, because you might see Lord Ravencourt as, you know, as I described him from your book, you know, this disgusting obese character. And I love the chins, the subtle chins. But I thought it was a really good exploration of empathy.
Yeah, and that the entire book was... Because the entire book is so dark, there's so much violence in there, and it's brutal violence when it occurs, and everyone's got secrets, and everyone's got schemes, and everyone's up to something. The light came from a couple of sources, and we needed to have some light. So some of it was some of the idea of jokes and the humour that kind of finds its way in there sporadically. But a lot of it came from Aidan. It came from his positivity. It came from the idea of empathy, that he would have to lean on these hosts. He would have to find the value in them to get out of this problem that he's been set to solve this mystery. And that's kind of that idea of Aidan being this sort of overwhelmingly positive, empathetic, hopeful character. It's kind of like beautifully at odds with this grim, foreboding setting.
And I loved that you are impacted by your physical appearance, and that was really telling each time he moved into the different bodies, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that, again, all came from the plot idea, and it's a really... I feel horrible saying it because I feel like I'm just kicking out the foundations underneath the book, but every character is built entirely for the story that I need to tell at that moment, which is why, you know... why he's in the older guy towards the end. It's because I need to slow the book down. I need him to start thinking a different way about the mystery in front of him. And it was just it was a lovely writing challenge to sort of present myself with.
Absolutely. The whole way through it, I was thinking, you know, how did you write this and how did you structure it and pull those strands together, which we'll get to. I just want to just ask you, I really thought the exploration was really cool, or the physical characteristics, but figuring out, even though you have limitations, that was for a reason, and you need to kind of use those characters' strengths. And I think he struggled with that, especially with Lord Ravencourt, because he was this still character. But how great was it that no matter who you are or what you are, you just got to draw on those strengths and find them to be able to do something amazing?
Yeah, and exactly. And I think Aidan is a lot like the rest of us in the sense that he doesn't initially know that. He doesn't initially realise that. He's so consumed by kind of what he's lost and by his limitations and by what he's been prevented from doing. He doesn't initially see what he suddenly can do, what doors are open to him, what benefits these hosts give to him. And that's a really hard-won lesson throughout the book. But when it comes, he really does begin to use it. And it is kind of his avenue to escape in the end.
Did you have a character you enjoyed writing the most?
Ravencourt, yeah. I think that's everybody I've talked to likes Ravencourt the most, and I think it's because he is, to an extent, he's weirdly the most empathetic character. Mm-hmm. I obviously loved writing those sort of grotesque descriptions, But also, like, just he has one of the funniest relationships with his valet, Cunningham. That's quite a nice relationship, and you don't get a lot of those in the book. He is dry-witted in his own way. You sense a lot of, like, depth to him, even though it's never overtly explored. So there's a lot going on with that guy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sadness, too, behind, you know, the descriptions, because I really like how Aidan says, you know, my host can fight back. So you do get an essence of the person he's kind of wearing as well. And there was a lot of sadness behind him, too.
Yeah, I think with Ravencourt, he was the one who perhaps... He's the wealthy banker. He seems to have it all. But I think he's lost more than perhaps anybody else in the house, which is quite a big thing to say. But we don't really have time to go into it. I just wanted to kind of put that thread in there so that if you pull on it, you can see it. But yeah, writing those stuff and giving those characters those moments, because I only had like 10,000, 12,000 words per character to play with. It was a really fun writing challenge to try and suggest this depth of character without going into it.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, the Agatha Christie influence, I guess, of that old world setting, which I thought was so beautiful, so creepy. And it was almost like Cluedo had come to life as I was reading it. Tell us about the creation of the setting besides, you know, your influence from Agatha Christie. What did you want to create? Because it was kind of a timeless setting.
I wanted to create a house that nobody wanted to go into. The genesis of this actually was one of the very first conversations I ever had with my wife. I was telling her about this idea, and I was like, I want to do a Groundhog Day loop of an Agatha Christie novel using all the tropes, our upper class guests, the big party they've all been invited to. And my wife just pointed out straight away, she was like, so why would he ever want to escape? It's just a big party, like, with very wealthy people who have, like, lots of, like, games and food and wine. Where would he want to go to? So I realised I had to, at that point, create a compelling reason for him to want to get out of this loop. So I had to make the house as foreboding as possible, as looming as possible, as creepy as possible, as uncomfortable as possible, and make all the people absolutely horrendous. So for a lot of that, I leaned on gothic horror and gothic horror tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave the house a sense of personality. I tried to make it a character within the book, and everybody in the book is basically constantly talking about how they don't want to be in this house. They walk around the grounds, they go shooting, they do everything else they can apart from to be in the house, even though it's in the depths of winter in England.
I was about to say that, no matter how cold you are, you still don't want to be in the house. That's saying something.
Yeah, exactly. That idea that if you're in the house, you are just crushed beneath it. I love the feel of that.
Now, the novel, besides the mystery and intrigue, it's about redemption and forgiveness. Why was this important for you to explore?
I think because, again, we talk about it's a dark novel, and Agatha Christie murder mystery, they're kind of light and fluffy apart from what they actually are, if that makes sense. The writing of them is always quite frothy, the characters are quite frothy, but at the heart of it, there's usually ingenious, horrible murder and people being really, really horrible to each other. And I took that and effectively dialed it up by 1,000. And again, not to give plot spoilers, but a lot of the reasons for this, a lot of the interactions between the characters are very, very dark. And I have a personal bugbear about violence and when violence is used on television and when violence is used in novels. I sometimes feel people turn it into a fetish.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to enjoy it. It's so descriptive as if to be leering. And I hate that because I used to teach martial arts. I grew up in a relatively rough area. I know violence is, it's usually short, it's usually brutal, it's usually very, very ugly, and it usually seriously harms people for the rest of their life. And I wanted to do that with the violence in this book, so that when it does arrive, you are terrified of it, you are terrified about the people who wield it. So to balance all that out, you had to have these light themes, you had to have redemption, you had to have hope, you had to have empathy. The things fundamentally, the core values of my character, the things he's chasing, had to be the antithesis of everything that's around him. And because if I hadn't done that, the book would have just been a mire, it just would have been a swamp of unpleasantness. So it's kind of nice to have this light, I think, at the centre of it, have to this character you can root for and sort of like huddle behind.
Revelations are also such an important aspect of this book. And I was just thinking, how on earth did you plan and structure the book? Where did these revelations come from? Do you know when to drop them in? Was it a really complicated write for you?
Yeah, it was an incredibly complicated write. I mean, I spent 3 months planning it before I ever wrote a word of it, and that included, I had a massive Excel spreadsheet, which I think ran to something like 120 pages.
Wow.
It was every 2 minutes of every character's day, where they were in the house and what they were doing. And then I overlaid the main beats of that onto a massive map of the house and grounds, which I printed out and put on my wall so I could kind of see where everyone was in the house, how long it would take them to get where they needed to go, so I could make sure that nobody was teleporting anywhere to make it longer. Because I just wanted it to be fair. I wanted to make sure that all the way through it, the reader was getting the clues at the same time as the protagonist, to the point that I've made it first-person present tense. So it's almost real-time as you're reading it. The information comes to you as it comes to him. You can both process it at the same time, and you both need to make connections at the same time. I mean, you can hold on to the same information. So the plan was always that the day had to be bulletproof, because that's what this all rests upon, this 24-hour loop that he constantly go through. If there was any holes in that, I knew that the entire book would fall apart. So that I took that planning process so seriously. That's why I say I took 3 months and didn't allow myself to write a word until I was absolutely sure that it was nailed on. And then in terms of where the revelations come, they were in the plan, but sometimes if they clustered together, if they lost a bit of impact because perhaps like there'd been a bigger revelation than a smaller revelation, I would have to rethink how it was being presented, and that kind of affected the structure a great deal. I think in total there was something like 40 or 50 drafts of this.
Wow.
I constantly just chopping and changing and trying to take chapters out, put chapters in, move things so they were seen from a different character's viewpoint. Because there were some events that, for example, Belle saw, who's my first host, that ended up being seen by Ravencourt or ended up being seen by Davis. There was a lot of that, just constantly trying to find the best way of presenting information and action.
That's incredible, especially the 3 months of planning and not writing a word. Was it tempting to start to write?
It was, but I also knew I had no idea where I'd start.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I say, the timeline was so important, and I was so aware of that from the beginning. I knew that if I just started writing, likely what would happen is I would write something that just wouldn't work. It just wouldn't fit the timeline as it ultimately came out. So every time I, thought about writing, I didn't put anything down. Because, the very first thing, I had a wall of post-it notes, which were just things that I needed to remember. And the very first one of them that went up was the concept of the novel, and it just said time traveling, body hopping, murder mystery novel. and when you look at that post-it note, that kind of informs the rest of it. You're like, yeah, you can't come at that half-assed. You better know the beginning, the middle, and the end. You better know exactly how this is going to work. So that kind of kept me honest.
Wow. And how did you stay engaged with a piece of work that you'd spent 3 months planning? How did you keep yourself interested?
Well, thankfully, at that time, I wasn't writing full time. So I was still a freelance journalist. I had to pay bills and eat food and go to the pub with my mates. So I was working freelance maybe 3 or 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we were living in central London, which, looking back, is an incredibly stupid idea, to live in one of the most expensive places in the world while trying to write a novel nobody's paid you to write and working freelance to pay those bills. So it was pretty full on. So whenever I got time to write the book, I was just enormously grateful to have that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were so many of the time commitments, and I would just throw myself into it. So that for me was, it was kind of like a holiday time. It was so enjoyable, and it's just such an enjoyable book to write. There was always some angle on it. Like, I didn't write it chronologically, for example, so I would always wake up in the morning on my writing days and be like, well, this is what I feel like writing today, and that's what I would go and write.
I love that idea of being grateful to write, and I wonder if that will change for you. Your second novel, you're writing it at the moment. Do you have all the space and time in which to write that now?
Do I, hell. I've just had a, well, we just had, we've got an 8-month-old baby who was born almost exactly when I started writing this second novel. So it's been full on in a completely different way, because I got a 2-book publishing deal from Raven, so that allowed me, and the first book was quite successful, so that allowed me to write full time. But my daughter has taken up a lot of that time.
Yes,
at least
I
initially. And there's something else. And because Seven Deaths did quite well, there's obviously press commitments for that now.
Yep.
There's media, there's interviews. So again, in a weird way, like, I've gone back to the old 3 days on, sort of 4 days. Like, it's just, it's working very, very similar to how it did.
I think, though, there's something in the idea of being grateful to write, because maybe if you have, like, I don't know, days to write, these empty days, you might kind of procrastinate or spend too much time on eBay or something. But when you've got finite time and you're grateful to write, you might get more done or more quality work done.
I did notice that with Ada. I mean, when she was born, especially in the beginning, she consumed so much time that I would only have an hour here, an hour there. Mm-hmm. And when I would get those little pockets, I would like throw myself down it like a rabbit down a well. I would just, it was insane. And then I would just come out and I'd be incredibly productive for like 50 minutes. In a way that now she's a bit older and I've got a bit more time, I'm definitely not. I definitely noticed that I'm a bit slower, I'm a bit laxer. I mean, I'm in the editing phase of the book now. It's actually due to my publisher on the 1st of March. So the kind of process has changed, but yeah, I really did enjoy those like pockets of time just because of how manically productive I was.
You probably treasure those moments because you know it is only an hour here and only an hour there, so you can't, you know, mess around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's always time for Twitter, but you do end up being like, well, that was like 25 minutes and you bash out 5-6 good pages. Yeah, I don't know. There must be something in the human brain when we feel under pressure, we can sometimes crank out our best stuff.
Now, tell me about the publishing journey. How did you first pitch this novel? Because, it, you know, when you talk about, oh, yeah, time traveling, body hopping, it doesn't really explain the depth and complexity and richness of this novel. So how did you pitch it and then get a publishing deal?
It's interesting. I mean, the pitching process, I swiftly learned, wasn't about depth at all. Nobody wanted to know about the philosophy of the novel. Nobody particularly wanted to know about the Agatha Christie kind of machinations of the novel. All they wanted was an elevator pitch and a reason why the market would be interested in it right now.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to my agent, because I put on submission, I was just a slush pile author like everybody else. When I sent it to 5 agents in the UK, there were only 5 agents in the UK who were representing what they call cross-genre crime, which is what it turns out I've written, which I obviously didn't know before I started. So I sent it to 5, and my elevator pitch line was Agatha Christie in a Groundhog Day style loop. And that was it. That's all it was. And then I went on with the rest of the letter to kind of explain some of the body swapping and explain that it was, you know, it would appeal to fans of Agatha Christie, it would appeal to fans of this genre of science fiction.
I just loved it. I devoured it and I couldn't stop reading it because I just thought it was so unique and different. And I read a lot of books for the podcast and I'm a teacher, English teacher by day. And honestly, it was just something like I'd never read before.
Oh, thanks very much. I mean, again, it's just when you set out, you don't know, at least when I set out, I didn't even know if I could pull this off. Like, I had the idea and I had my concept, but I didn't know if it was going to pull together. I didn't know if any of these things could actually work in one novel. So it was really, really risky and weird. And I'd convinced my wife, who was then my girlfriend, we lived in Dubai at the time, and I convinced her to come back to England with me because I knew I needed to be in England to write it. Because I needed, you know, I needed rain, I needed grey skies, I needed these houses and these types of people at hand. So I put a lot on the line to do it. And so I'd gone from a relatively high paying job in Dubai to being freelance in the UK and earning just enough money to pay my bills. So to come out now and be having this conversation, it still boggles the mind. I'm still like, why did I? God, I must have possessed some arrogance, but I can't remember what it was.
Maybe it was self-belief.
I don't feel like it. Yeah, I don't know. I think it was, I've wanted to write this book since I was 8 years old. I wanted to write an Agatha Christie, I should say, since I was 8 years old. So I suspect it was just, once the idea came to me, it possessed me completely. I just had to write it. I had no option. And I think it was more that than anything else. It was just the crushing weight of my own history.
So you were reading Agatha Christie quite young.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My neighbour, Doris, would bring around stacks of them. She would go to car boot sales and just buy 10, 15 of these books for 10 pence each. And she would bring them round on a Saturday morning and just hand them to me. And I would devour them over the course of a week. and then she would go and buy another set and bring them over. And that's what I did for about a year or two, just kept reading these books one after another.
And what was it about them that really made you devour them and love them and want to keep reading them?
I like that they were a game, I think. They felt like board games to me. I felt like every time you opened one, you were kind of sat down on the other side of a board from Agatha Christie, and she would very carefully lay her pieces down. She usually gave you a map of the house or wherever the novel would be set, and she would give you the clues as you went along. And I felt the challenge in every one was fair. It was like, you can sit down, you can play, and you can win. All you've got to do is be smarter than Agatha Christie. And, you know, like, 2 times out of 10 I would get there. I would sort of solve the mystery ahead of her. But that was, and it was such a thrill when I did. So I always enjoyed that sense that, is this the one I'm going to solve? Is this the one where I beat her? And, you know, it was for an 8-year-old, for a 10-year-old, it's just such great fun.
And I guess I read your novel in the same way. I was kind of hoping the whole way through that there was going to be this, you know, incredible sort of revelation that I couldn't guess, because, you know, I actually like not guessing the puzzle. I like being surprised. And you really did that for me, so thank you.
It's been much. Well, the actual ending of the book, especially the revelation about the murder, how it's committed, who committed it, all that sort of stuff, that was the very first planning challenge. So, because if you just think about it, like, you've got a time-traveling detective. His first logical thought to solve a murder would be, I'll just follow the victim around and see who, like, you know, bops her on the head or shoots her or stabs her or poisons her or whatever it is. He would just follow her around and see what happens to her. So from that point onwards, I had to work backwards to try and deconstruct this murder. And you end up coming up with this incredibly silly, elaborate murder that no one would ever commit in real life because you're so desperate to stump the detective. And then you've got to work backwards from that again, pull all that apart and find the bits that work. What is a murder somebody would realistically commit, and then give them a good reason for doing it that way? And that alone took weeks, just coming up with that and making sure it held and that you could prod the edges of it and it didn't fall down. So yeah, to get that in and sort of like see that, because that's what holds the entire weight of the rest of the novel. I think if you get to the murder solution and you are not satisfied, the entire book crumbles. So that was incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. And as the reader, it was as well, you know, because you are hoping, because, you know, you invest a lot of time in it. It's not a thin book. It's, what, 500 pages? How many words did it come to?
132,000.
Yeah, I thought it was might have been around 120 mark. And so you're investing a lot of time, so it's very satisfying when you get that ending and go, ah, yes, excellent.
Yeah, I mean, that is the other thing. Like, I'm so keenly aware of how much time I'm asking of people, that you want to reward that, you want to justify it. You're constantly kind of apologising for making people sit down for those extra minutes and those extra hours. There's lots of other things they could be doing. So you kind of constantly, the book needs to say to the reader, you know, okay, you're doing this rather than watching Netflix or playing a video game or going for a run or, you know, tending your family or making your dog dinner. But this is what I give you. And I suspect that's why it's got so many revelations as well, because you're constantly just trying to keep hold of your reader.
But I think when you broke it down, because it didn't feel like, you know, 130,000 words, you know, sometimes you feel that in a book, but for me, it didn't feel like that. And I think that's because, as you said, each character only had, you know, about 10,000 words. And so when you were getting really stuck into, you know, Lord Ravencourt, for example, you kind of wanted more of him or more of all the other characters that you're reading. And when you've only got 10,000 words of each, it kind of breaks it down a bit for you, doesn't it? So it doesn't feel like such a long read.
Yeah, exactly. And I never really thought about it in those terms, but the idea of having loads of different characters who constantly give you a slightly different buzz or energy or something. So even if you did start to get a little bit tired of one of the characters, you'll be on somebody else soon enough. Or that's when we started to mess with the structure of the novel as well. And again, the slight spoilers in that. But the structure doesn't always necessarily do what you're expecting. And that was another way of sort of like rewarding readers or wrong-footing them or causing tension, was just to sort of like, yeah, there's 10,000 words of one character, but what about dole this out in a slightly different way now? How will you feel about that? Fun. Just talking about it now, I just remember how much fun that was.
That's good. And I could just, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think, wow, this writing process and this planning process just must have been wild. Now, winner of the Costa Book Awards too. This must feel pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was all right. I should just note that it was, I won the first novel category, not the overall thing. That went to another, that an absolutely exceptional book called The Cutout Girl, that won the overall award this year. But I won the first novel, which I'm immensely proud of, because again, writing this book, I didn't know if I'd pull it off, but I also didn't know if anybody would read it when I did write it. I just assumed that my family would and a few of my friends, and that might be as far as they got. So to find that it's been embraced on a wider stage is awesome.
Amazing. Now, I don't know if you can tell me much about the new book that's nearly finished. Can you tell us anything about it?
I've got another year of editing ahead of me, probably.
Fair enough.
And with Seven Deaths, I chopped that book up, rearranged it, got rid of characters, put new characters in, almost entirely changed the theme of the novel during the editing. So I'd just be lying to you, and I'd feel terrible about that. The other thing to say about it is I think it's gonna mash up a few genres again, and I think hopefully it should be a fun read the way Seven Deaths was, and just move at quite a clip.
Yeah, and that's what I really liked about Seven Deaths, just the fun of it as well, and it really pushes you forward, so I loved it. So, look, thank you for writing it. It was such a great read. As soon as, you know, I started reading about the book, I really wanted to get my hands on it, and once I did, I was like, I have to speak to you about this book because it was so enjoyable. And then I put it on Facebook that I'd been reading it, and other people have been like, oh, I've got my hands on this too. What do you think? And everyone's like, this is just such a wild ride. So everyone who has read it, who I have spoken to, just think it's such a wonderful, rich, crazy, humorous, unique book. So thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you so much for reading it. I mean, that makes all the difference. Otherwise, I'm just a guy who spent 3 years bashing away at a keyboard to put a book on a shelf that nobody ever saw. So you guys are brilliant. Thank you.